listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. I'm very excited about today's show. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Steve Almond, author of the story collections My Life in Heavy Metal and The Evil B.B. Chow, the novel Which Brings Me to You, which he wrote with Juliana Baggett, and the nonfiction books Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, Candy Freak, and Not That You Asked. He is a regular contributor for many publications, including Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Real Simple, Salon.com, Virginia Quarterly Review, Utney Reader, The Sun, Huffington Post, and Nerve.com. And he also writes for one of my favorite websites. Very frequently he writes for The Rumpus. His third book of stories, God Bless America, has just come out from the University of North Carolina's Lookout Press. And a story from this collection, which was called Donkey Greedy, Donkey Gets Punched, was included in the 2010 Best American Short Stories collection. When I spoke to Steve Almond last month, I began by asking him to talk about his decision to collect his stories into this latest book, God Bless America.
Well, yeah, it's an odd thing. I'm not a, you know, oftentimes there's a writers will naturally write sort of a cycle of stories, or just as frequently, I think, somebody, an agent or an editor will say, gee, why don't you write linked stories, you know, something that we can kind of, you know, pitch as a novel or a single narrative somehow. And although I've written a number of stories that have the same characters, the characters who recur, I tend to, with collections, all I'm interested in is getting the best stories, you know, into one book. Mm-hmm. Pretty much just looking at whatever I produce, because I write a lot of short fiction. I used to write more before I had kids, but, you know, I just, that's what I love. Short stories are the natural form, I think, that I gravitate towards. So mm-hmm. I pretty much, you know, every 5 or 6 years, I think, I sort of look at what I have and say, do I have enough good stories to make a book?
Right.
That is worth asking, you know, is worth putting out into the world, because that's, you know, I have plenty of stories, but that's not really the threshold. Getting 12 together isn't good enough in this culture, I don't think, to ask people to invest the sort of time and attention and love, really, that it requires for people to read a book. So, you know, I felt that I had gotten to that point where I had a lot of stories, and I really wanted to, I'd had this experience of being in the nonfiction world for 2 straight books with a big publisher, and that was very interesting and wonderful in its own way, but I missed short stories. Mm-hmm. I missed the intensity of them and the kind of emotional and sensual compression. And so I just wanted to be in that world again, and I gathered up a bunch of stories and I sent them out to very small presses for the simple reason that I was also ready to not to uncouple artistic creation from financial expectation. Because
mm-hmm.
those two, for me, and I think for most writers, you know, financial expectation acts upon the artistic intent like hydrochloric acid acts upon the skin. It's just not a good combination. So I wanted to go with the small press because I knew they would be sort of leaner and meaner, and I just wanted to find a great editor. And much to my delight, Ben George, an editor who I'd worked with at Tin House and Ecotone, the magazine that he edits, you know, basically wrote me a 6-page letter about not just the manuscript I'd sent him, but all the other stories of mine he'd read and sort of what he felt was, what he felt I was up to in my work.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, you dream as a writer of getting such a letter where somebody's really paid attention to what you're doing more closely in some ways than I have, because I'm not conscious of what I'm trying to do. But I think to kind of circle back to your original question, I feel like I've been living in the United States for 10 years, the last 10 years, and feeling very intensely the loneliness of the culture, the tolls of being in this perpetual war, the kind of racial anxieties and class anxieties that we're not able to get past despite all the, you know, sort of marketing to the contrary, and the way in which Americans are sort of hurtling faster and faster through time and space and consciousness kind of on this speeding treadmill, and at the same time, time that they're moving faster and faster, and the information around them is moving faster and faster, and the buy messages and the marketing, they're falling away from their families, from a sense of connection to their own internal lives and their kind of duties to their fellow citizens. And that stuff I'm just thinking about and worrying about constantly. So I think, you know, any time a collection of stories, no matter how disparate the furniture and the stories is, the setting and the, you know, point of view and all that stuff, you're always getting one person's preoccupations and obsessions. Mm-hmm. You know, I circle around to the same stuff over and over again. And I think that's why I called the collection God Bless America, because I, you know, I do think about the country. I think we're the greatest country on earth. We have the greatest ideals ever set out, and when we put our mind to it, we've made unbelievable moral progress.
Yeah.
But this is a time I feel like deeply and kind of tragically where I think we're moving backwards morally and toward disaster.
Right. Right. And that preoccupation, as you put it, is the thing that links this collection together. Whether or not you set out to create a linked collection, it's just because the authors mind is on certain ideas, those are the ideas that are going to come together naturally.
Right, that's it. And for instance, just to give, and it's not just a, you know, this isn't a book that's political. I think it's moral because I think every piece of art is moral. It's asking people to feel more than they've felt before, and that's a moral act. You know, because I do political writing, people often assume, you know, God Bless America, oh, Almond sounding off about America in some way. And, you know, anybody who reads the stories will be disappointed if that's what they, you know, come in expecting.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, you know, basically the 13 characters. That's how I write stories. I find a character or a character finds me, and I just, my job is just to push them into danger. Whatever it is they desire, whatever it is they're frightened of, whatever it is they regret, it's my job as the author to push them up against it and to slow down where it really gets tough for them, because that's where, for me, the language has to stretch and sort of become more lyric in order to describe what it's like when we're overrun by feeling. That experience is something that, you know, only artists are interested in that. The marketers don't want you to think about your own anxiety and turmoil and the stuff that really deep down, you know, is where you live. The deepest regrets, the deepest unmet desires, even the deepest moments of ecstasy, which have nothing to do with making a purchase. You know, they have to do with something very deep and internal inside you that's happening. But art is aimed directly at that stuff. That's what its job is to traffic in the unbearable and uncontrollable feelings. So, you know, that's always what I'm doing. And even if the, you know, a story like God Bless America, the title story is a story about American, the American dream, the idea of reinventing yourself, the desires that we keep throttled, and how dangerous and exhilarating it is when we finally start to connect to ourselves and figure out the kind of the bigger story we want to tell with our lives. But there are a lot of stories that, you know, I wasn't even conscious of kind of where they come from. And as an example, there are so many unhappy mothers in this collection. It was pointed out to me.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't conscious of that. I just would write about, you know, these stories with female narrators, and suddenly they would be moms, and suddenly they would be, you know, kind of heartbroken moms whose families in one way or another have you know, done them wrong and bullied them and abandoned them. And, you know, when I think about why that is, it's immediately obvious, though it wasn't obvious at all when I was writing the stories. It's because I grew up in a family that was pretty rough, with a couple of brothers and, you know, a very successful but in many ways self-absorbed dad. And my mom was the central recipient of that male trouble. She was disregarded. She was not accorded the respect that she should have been. And she really suffered by it. And I grew up witnessing that suffering. And, you know, so 30 or 40 years later, when I'm working on these stories, you know, that stuff never gets out of the groundwater. Those deepest feelings of regret and empathy and a sense that you could have done things better and you were complicit, I'm still working that stuff out, in other words.
Right, right. Now, I feel like some of this is what the publisher's material was talking about when the book is described as being a meditation on the American dream and its discontents. But your work is also very often described as very funny, hysterical. The New York Times Book Review called it always enjoyable, often hysterical. So I wondered if we could talk for a minute about how these two things interrelate, because they obviously do. You know, you are touching something very deep inside the reader, and yet you're making us laugh out loud. So how come that works so well?
I think about this a great deal because, you know, I'm in the ghetto that's, you know, the funny writer ghetto. And I know that, you know, people, if they're familiar with my work or they know Candy Freak or My Life in Heavy Metal or, you know, stuff I write for Salon or whatever, they think, oh, Almond, he's that funny writer.
Right, yeah.
But of course, you know, and that's cool. I mean, basically, a sense of humor is a kind of instinct that we develop, but it's essentially defensive in nature. It's defending against circumstances that are unbearable to face head on. So mm-hmm. we make jokes. And I grew up in a family, as I mentioned, that was pretty rough. And the armature that you develop is a sense of humor, both to win attention, but also to try to survive the worst moments. And, you know, but the comic impulse arises from feelings that are essentially tragic in nature, you know?
Sure.
Sorrow, rage, awkwardness, embarrassment, humiliation, shame, any book. Think about Birds of America by Laurie Moore. I mean, that's a collection of stories about women who are utterly lost, depressed, alienated, falling away from their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hysterical. You know, you think about Aristophanes, you know, go back to the beginning. It's the Greek playwright, and that's basically John Stewart in a toga, or vice versa, you know. I mean, he was expressing moral outrage at the state of the democracy he was faced with. You know, you really look at what Colbert and Stewart are doing every night, and it is much more, in a much more clear-eyed way, taking stock of the unbelievable immorality, hypocrisy, and cruelty of our political culture just every night. And there's endless fodder for them. The first person to, in the mass culture in the United States, to call out Nazism, to say in an overt way there is a country where they are turning people into killing machines, was Charlie Chaplin. You know, the great dictator, 1940. We're still at peace with Germany. So there's this tradition of, I think because of this, the Aristotelian notion of, you know, there are these different modes and there's the tragic and the comic, that somehow those are distinct and even opposed, that if you write funny, it can't be serious, and if you write serious, it can't be funny. But my experience tells me that the sadder a story gets, the funnier it gets.
Right,
because
right.
The humor is necessary, and it's not something I consciously put on the story. It's something that I require as the writer to look at and in a sense forgive moments that are too painful to look at any other way.
Mm-hmm. The two words that you used in speaking on both of these points was unbearable and I think uncontrollable, you said, and it's like both of those seem to work for strong emotions in either direction, both funny and sad or difficult or painful. And
that's right.
Yeah. Another thing that seems relevant to me. I read your Rumpus essay on Anthony Weiner, and you made this following statement. I didn't want to necessarily get into the subject of that essay so much, but you made this statement that really struck me, which was, we are forever telling the world the same two stories about ourselves. One is about the person we want to believe we are, wise, compassionate, understanding, and the other is about the person we know ourselves to be, petty, cruel, sexually destructive, and the best of our literary art arises from the collision of these two stories. And it felt a little bit to me like this was relevant to the idea of our being able to be devastated and funny at the same time, too.
Yeah, I mean, what humor is I mean, there are a number of things specifically that make us laugh. And one is that somebody reaches the truth with a greater velocity than we're accustomed to. And we laugh in a sense of gratitude and astonishment and even discomfort.
Yeah.
The great comedians were always doing that. They get to the insights quicker than we're used to and by more innovative paths. It's also, there's something in humor that is inherently, it's a radical form of discourse. It's essentially trafficking in the id. You know, things are funny because they're outside our normal boundaries of propriety. You know, Lenny Bruce, you know, announcing that he's now going to urinate on the audience, and everybody laughs because it's so disturbing and unexpected, and there's this kind of delight and even this frisson of terror, like, wow, this guy is ready to go to the id.
Yeah.
He's out of control. Anything could happen. And that's the thing about humor, is that, you know, the only person who can who can tell George W. Bush what a pathetic, sadistic, deluded frat boy he really is Stephen Colbert. Mm-hmm. You know, just like the fool is the only person who can speak truth to King Lear. But that's true, you know, for Laurie Moore, for, you know, any of the other great sort of George Saunders, any of the other great humorists of our time in a literary sense, is they're the ones who are willing to say, look, I know there's this polite story of how everybody's supposed to be, but here's really how people are. Here's really the place they live in. And I'm going to force you to see it, but the dividend is forgiveness, and the laughter is the forgiveness. You know, I'm going to allow you to look at this because I'm going to make you laugh while you're looking at it. And so you'll be distracted from how deeply sad it is. Or maybe you'll forgive yourself and recognize, I'm that sad too. This is that second story of how we know ourselves to be, all of our fears and anxiety and our smallness as people, is something that's shared. And great comedians remind us that, and I don't mean comedians just up on a stage, I mean any great comic writer or, you know, somebody who's a funny person is essentially doing the work of reminding us that we all have that second sort of pathetic story inside of us, and we feel comforted and less alone with it. And that's part of the reason people laugh as well. They're out of relief.
I think that being that person who's able to bring that across through humor or just in general, it takes a lot of courage. And I was thinking about this as I read your stories. You know, you don't tend to pull your punches at all. You have characters who are racist, characters who are crude, characters like Jacob in A Jew Berserk on Christmas Eve who just really wants to get laid so badly. And I'm just wondering, do you ever have to sort of like encourage yourself onward and say, yes, go there, you know, don't back off? Is that hard? Is that scary?
Well, it isn't scary for my given terrain because, you know, I'm 45. I've been doing this for 20 years, basically, and seriously for probably 15. So for me, that's when it gets good. You know, every humiliating experience for me is later to be converted into a funny episode or an episode where I was really feeling life intensely. But there's plenty of stuff that I'm not able to write about. I don't have the courage to write about it. Writing is about radical disclosure. What every reader wants is to hear the truth, just to hear the truth about the things that matter the most deeply to the writer. Whether it's in fictional disguise or not, that's what we're reading for. We want those intense, unbearable, out-of-control emotions precisely because life, the normal, polite, everyday life, deprives us of those feelings. And we have to walk around pretending like we all can keep it together all the time. And, you know, so I'm always aiming at that stuff, but there's a lot of things that, you know, certainly I'd never be able to write about in a non-fictional sense because it's too painful, and it would cause pain to people around me, but also I'm just not ready to. There's stuff that I'm delighted to get into, but there's a lot that I cannot consciously bring myself to, and even unconsciously. And I think that a writing career is about developing the capacity to pay attention for a longer period of time, to stay in these sort of complex and oftentimes painful states that your characters come to or you push your characters to. But also, it's about expanding the amount of how radically honest you're willing to be and about what things in your life. Because that's the single thing that the reader wants. The reader wants the unvarnished truth. And every writer can, you know, sort of be truthful in that way about certain things in his or her life. But there are also things that are too frightening and too upsetting. And there's plenty of that stuff in my life. The things that, in one way or another, consciously or unconsciously, I'm not able to grapple with yet. But I still got some years to go, and I do feel like you expand that zone of being comfortable, you know, writing about a painful area. I feel like that's something you can improve at.
Mm-hmm. What about the readers who read for escape?
There's a lot of people who just want to get on their flight from Cleveland to Pittsburgh, you know, and they just want to get through it. And that's a form of entertainment and reading, too, and I don't want to knock it, but what I'm trying to do, especially with a book of stories like this and what probably puts this artifact way out on the cultural margin, is, you know, I want to get as emotionally real as I can, and I want the kind of readers who are willing to admit and, you know, willing to go there with me. And I know that it's not as great a number, and I know that there's way more people reading Harry Potter or, you know, the Twilight Saga or whatever it is, who are much more interested in adventure and an active imagination that is more heroic and less dangerous, that doesn't traffic in all these unbearable, uncontrollable feelings. And I can't, you know, I can't fault people for that. That's their desires. I can't make them want to go to my weirdo, intense world. But I kind of see it as my job to, as much as I can, bring that possibility of looking at their own internal lives and just the lives of the people around them more deeply. Like, I'm always trying to bring that to people. I read that story, A Jew Berserk, on Christmas Eve at this little college out in Brevard down here in North Carolina where I am right now. And, you know, there's 100 kids in the room. Probably 90 of them were forced to be there by teachers. And, you know, it's a story about a college kid who wants to get laid and all the freaky stuff that he discovers about his straight-laced girlfriend's family. And it's making the larger point that we are all freaks, you know, underneath whatever veneer we have, whether in action or in fantasy, you know, in imagination, we are all filled with perversity. That's just part of the basic human arrangement. And, you know, a few kids, I think, having heard that story, will read more of my work, or will just be more inclined to think of books and literature as something that is about them, not above them. Mm-hmm. And that's the larger mission. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. All right, well, so let's get back to talking about God Bless America. I wanted to talk about the story called Tamal Pais. Is that correctly pronounced?
It's actually called Tamal Pais.
Tamal Pais.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This story felt so real to me, and I finished it and thought that you had probably worked for such a place, and that you had worked as a waiter, and that you had probably, I don't want to give anything away, but you had probably ridden your bike too fast in dangerous circumstances at times. And maybe you're just really good at taking what you have experienced and creating fiction around it, and none of this is true about you. But I was just wondering if you can talk about this story, how it started, and what you drew upon to write about this character.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So the basic plot is that there's this kid who's trying to escape. He's trying to escape an unhappy mother. There she is,
yeah.
and a little sister who's troubled, and they're really dependent on him. And he's, you know, 16 or 17 years old, and he's working at this fancy restaurant at the top of Mount Tamal Pais in Mill Valley. And in walks, and he feels like he can see Cal Berkeley, where he wants to go. He's an ambitious kind of scholarship kid, and he can see his dream, you know, from up on top of Mount Tamal Pais, and he's delighted to be working in this fancy restaurant. It feels like sort of the introduction to a bigger life, the bigger life that he wants to lead. And into his life walks basically an older and, clearly, as the story progresses, quite mentally disturbed patron who he has to serve. And he increasingly becomes freaked out by the awareness, as we do when we see people who we recognize are mentally ill. You know, it's terrifying to us, and especially terrifying to this guy because he lives with a little sister who's already at a young age. It's clear that she's emotionally and mentally disturbed. And the story came from, I think, a couple of things, and this is the thing I love about short stories, is that, you know, they come from your artistic unconscious. They come from, you know, it's sort of like this incredibly powerful blender, and, you know, the story just ends up being what it is, but it's configured from all these ingredients that have been served up by your artistic unconscious. So the main one was a friend of mine telling me this story. That's the basic bare-bones story of Tamal Pais. The reason it stuck with me and resonated with me is because I worked, you know, in mostly in ice cream parlors, but, you know, I worked in neighborhoods, and I lived in a town where I lived in a very middle-class, lower-middle-class part of a town that was extraordinarily wealthy, and I would always visit these places. And I was also in a family that was pretty charged, from which I was clearly trying to escape. Mm-hmm. So the reason that this kid's story really resonated for me was because it was a version of my story. And I can remember riding my bike from the south end of Palo Alto, California, where I grew up, which was before Apple and, you know, Silicon Valley really happened. It was just a kind of sleepy college town. But there were always these incredibly wealthy parts of Palo Alto, downtown Palo Alto, these huge mansions. You know, we lived in a house that was probably, it was a little Eichler that was probably 900 square feet. And I shared a room with my brothers until we were, I think, 13, you know, or 12 right. or 13. So, and it's not like we were poor. Nobody in America is really poor relative to the developing world. But, you know, when you can see the 1% and you know, I remember riding my bike and there would be these huge houses with these beautiful lawns, and it was a real Gatsby moment. And I was riding my bike to this fancy ice cream parlor that I worked at. There was sort of a restaurant ice cream parlor. And, you know, I was serving mostly people who had some dough. And, you know, I remember going on a date with a woman who I'd met. She was from Los Altos Hills, which was super wealthy. And I remember just arriving at that date, and I was sort of sweaty and gross because I'd ridden my bike. And she was just the picture of immaculate, you know, sort of mm-hmm. dressed in white and with hair, you know, her hair was done up just so. And I just remembered feeling like I am this disgusting, you know, lower middle class kid trying to figure out how to have not just the wealth, but the ease and assurance that comes with that kind of wealth. And those feelings really are in the groundwater for me. It's the reason that there's a fair amount about class and the collection. Mm-hmm. And that story is very much about, you know, sort of this kid's desire to escape from what his circumstances are. And yet at the same time to recognize that we're all really on a knife's edge of madness. It only takes one moment, one episode to sort of flip over and into really dangerous self-destructive behavior. Especially when you are doing something that deep down you feel very guilty about, which is trying to abandon your family, trying to mm-hmm. escape from your family. And that stuff, frankly, that is just part of my human equipment. I carry it around, and those preoccupations are going to find their way into the stories. Not consciously. I'm just trying to push that kid into trouble. But, you know, your artistic unconscious is always circling back to those preoccupations.
And it is fascinating, isn't it, later to look back on your work and see these, I'll call them themes, but to see these repeating patterns of what you were thinking about, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, I had no clue that there were all these unhappy moms in this collection until a female reader pointed it out. And she just was like, what is going on? Every story or every other story, there's some mom. And the moment she said it, I knew exactly how it had gotten in there.
Well, here, another detail about this story that really struck me was that I knew from the start that this woman was going to be mentally ill. I just knew it from the start, and it's not like you presented her that way right away in an obvious sense. But, I looked back after reading it to try and understand how you had set that up. I think it was just a combination of her contemplative pose, she's sort of staring out the window, and also how much this other waiter in the restaurant does not want to deal with 13, which was her table number.
Right.
But I wonder if you can talk about that. Were you trying to include any hints as to her emotional state, you know, from the start?
Well, what you're trying to do with a story like that is keep us in the consciousness of this kid. So he has a vague sense that something's amiss. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But he's 16, and he doesn't really know. It's, you know, he might describe it. If we could sit that kid down for an interview and say, so tell me about that night. He'd say, I don't know, you know, I didn't, there's this woman that the feather, the other waiter, you know, didn't want to serve, and she looked kind of weird, but whatever, you know, it's a table, it's part of my responsibility. So, and then, you know what I mean, he wouldn't say right from the outset, she was a nutbag and I could see it, because he's too young.
Right.
So the story, I don't think fairly can be that diagnostic that early on. It's that creeping sense of something is amiss here. Uh-oh, something is more amiss and more amiss. And, you know, my folks are both psychoanalysts, and before that they were psychiatrists, and mm-hmm. I've certainly spent plenty of time on couches, you know, paying somebody to cure my soul expensively. And so I'm sort of familiar with... And I've worked also and volunteered in mental health facilities, and I'm really familiar with how disquieting it is to recognize madness. Just the way people react to me when I say that my folks do that line of work tells me every time I reveal it how uncomfortable people are about their own mental stability, because they always react in this big, grandiose way and say, oh, well, you must be crazy. But really what they're telling me is, I'm made uncomfortable by the fact that your parents are psychoanalysts, because I think people tend to be a little bit frightened of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, because everybody, as we've talked about, is guarding this secret crazy person inside. And when we see it in the external world, it really freaks us out. You know, I think our own hold on our own normalcy is pretty tenuous. And, you know, so when we see somebody who clearly can't control their behavior, it terrifies us deeply, because we recognize that there but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah.
So this kid can't know immediately, but he has intimations, and that's what I wanted the reader to have, that sort of slow seep of dread where one thing after another leads us to see that she's more and more out of control.
Yeah. Well, that was a great story. I'm thinking this might be a good time for you to read from God Bless America.
Sure. So just to set this up a little bit, the story is called God Bless America, and it's about Billy Clam, who is a guy who wanders into the wrong adult ed classroom, and he thinks it's a tax loophole course, and it's in fact an acting class, and he's immediately struck by the idea of becoming an actor, which is entirely far-fetched. He's totally unqualified, but, you know, it strikes the happy gong, and he can't help himself. So I'll just read a little bit. So he gets a job as a duck tour, but, you know, operator.
Which was great.
People who drive around Boston saying, you know, spitting historical facts about Boston, and anybody who's lived in Boston, they're sort of the social tourist equivalent of large cockroaches. You know, they kind of zip around, and you can always hear them because they're mic'd up. So I figured an actor would really, a struggling, ambitious, just beginning actor would really see this as amazing. Being a Sammy Duck tour guide was not technically an acting job, but it had elements of craft, such as speaking before a captive audience and interacting with the other guides at red lights where they were supposed to perform little skits. There was also a reenactment of the Boston Tea Party, which was held at the end of the tour near the harbor and was clearly the dramatic highlight of the day. A Tea Party role was something you worked your way up to, in other words, a first step that would lead to more ambitious steps, such as clown gigs. Traffic was difficult to negotiate in a duckmobile. They cornered poorly. Then, too, there was the microphone clamp, which dug into the side of Billy's skull and caused tension headaches, and his costume, which his father claimed made him look like a homosexual pirate. But these were small matters. Within a couple of months, Billy had memorized the script and even begun to go off script when he felt this would be a lucrative artistic decision. So that now, for instance, as the duckmobile barreled down Boylston with the common yellow-green under the rippling June air, Billy flicked on his microphone and said, "Quack, quack! To your left, duckies, is the famous Boston Common. In days of yore, cows were led here to graze. Its bucolic wonders inspired many of Ralph Waldo Emerson's essays, as well as a little-known skirmish during the War of Independence, the Battle of the Lawn. What do you think about that?" From in back, Billy heard a group of child duckies burping in unison, which wasn't a thought, technically, but did reflect a spirit of improvisation. "Quack, quack! We're now entering Beacon Hill. This stately neighborhood of red brick and cobbled streets was the original home to Boston's aristocracy. It is named after Ebenezer Beacon, who coincidentally is the same person who inspired Charles Dickens to write the novel Ebenezer Scrooge. He was a stingy grocer who would not allow poor families to borrow against his larder until he had a vision of God. He then wrote the song Amazing Grace, which many black churches sing to this day." So obviously he's improvising. People are often wonder where I got those facts, and of course I always tell them I got them from Michelle Bachman's website. But I'll read a little bit further here. Further along in life, when he penned his memoirs, Billy would look back on these days fondly as an era full of the material necessary to the actor's craft. He was not one of those stars who had made it too easy, thank God, and spent his life behind a wall of security. He was more like a young Brando who learned his parts by spending time among stevedores and roustabouts and other interestingly named laborers. It was unfortunate that not all the guides shared Billy's enthusiasm, but what Billy had learned by studying his country's history was that America had been built by opportunists. It was a large and prosperous nation, and one that could accommodate less enthused people, people like his pop, who had never showed much enthusiasm for anything, aside from Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra. Billy had once caught Pop sitting in his bedroom with the lights out just after Ma passed, singing "This is no dream," to himself in a shy, reedy voice, his socks twitching on the floorboards. Probably Pop had wanted to be a singer, and in another era, one with lots of little villages and people like bards and so forth, he might have been. But this was America, the land of opportunists, and here it wasn't enough to want something. You had to fight for what you wanted, and fight hard, fight through your own resistance and the jeers of others and physical adversity, which was what the Pilgrims had done, vis-a-vis the whole Thanksgiving situation, and after them, the colonists, who had bucked the most powerful empire on Earth, even though they were basically just a bunch of underfed tax evaders. And then the pioneers. No, you couldn't forget the pioneers who had traversed vast prairies and mountains and battled Indians and grizzly bears and inclement weather and various kinds of pox. And some had even starved and had to eat each other to survive, which, by the way, would make a terrific film treatment, Billy thought, because it said so much about the indomitable spirit that had built the country. Not that cannibalism was part of the indomitable American spirit, but it did show how far some people would go to find good real estate.
So that's great.
You know, that's Billy Clam, you know.
That's great.
He's a true believer in the American dream.
In the American dream. Thank you very much for reading that. And I'll just mention that's Steve Almond reading from God Bless America, which is published by Lookout Books, University of North Carolina. So I wanted to ask you about Billy. Billy ends up in this career that he hadn't expected to be in, basically by stumbling into the wrong class, which was great. And it's funny, maybe, you know, I think sometimes we can read too much into these things. But when I was reading this story, it sort of felt a little bit to me like Billy could be seen as a metaphor for America and all of the opportunity that we have and how we mostly kind of stumble around with it rather than taking advantage of it. But I don't know if that's what you intended.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's important to notice that, I mean, Billy is 35, you know, mm-hmm. So he's not a college kid. He's kind of given up. I mean, you know, he's sort of stocking the shelves at a drugstore. And, I mean, if I meant anything, I was trying to connect to the way in which Americans have these dreams, and they're usually big dreams. They're usually dreams about being famous. But underneath that kind of narcissistic dream is really a very beautiful and much more human dream. That is that people are going to connect to themselves. You know, there's all the stuff that, the thing that resonates for him when his teacher is sort of up there, you know, speaking about being an actor, and he's totally pompous and over the top, but the thing that he says that really connects is, do any of you have a sense of being disconnected from this one and only life of yours? And, you know, that's America to me.
Yeah.
Americans have lots of stuff. They have lots of, and they make lots of purchases. You know, they have lots of forms of entertainment. They've got big houses. They've got warm houses. They've got a million different chocolate chip cookie varieties to choose from. But there's a kind of emptiness, a sort of yawning emptiness that we're trying to fill with all this stuff, with all these cookies and light beer and widescreen TVs and, you know, nachos and chicken wings. And, you know, we're just dumping everything we can, our SUVs, everything we can in, you know, bigger the better, to try to fill this kind of yawning chasm inside of us. And that stuff's junk. It's emotional and intellectual junk food. It doesn't fill it. It just keeps you on a continuous quest for more and more stuff, more and more products. And we've really made the economic engine of the economy that kind of ravenous consumption. But what people really want deep down is to be known, to be seen and perceived, and to know themselves a little bit, to feel connected to their lives. And that's the basic American story, you know. And Billy Clam, to me, is like this heroic figure because he's at least going for it. And maybe it's not going to end well, and you know, but he's gone for it. He's trying to figure out who he is and connect to these deeper, more passionate feelings that are inside of him and not just give up. And, you know, make his peace with being yet another screen-addicted zombie, you know, kind of shoveling food in our maw. And I don't mean to be so cynical about Americans. I think Americans are, you know, incredibly heterogeneous group of people. But I see this very, you know, when I walk around, you go to any large supermarket or any mall, and you really see that people are in this kind of, it's almost like a, neurasthenic haze or something. They're just kind of wandering around from one shop to another to buy things.
Right.
And you almost want to shake them and say, what's happening in there? Who do you love? What do you want to be? You know, when was the last time you had a really intense emotional exchange with somebody in your life? You know, when was the last time you were recognized that all this stuff that you have, all these choices and all this abundance hasn't made you spiritually a richer person? And I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in God. I believe in people. You know, I believe that people are capable of that kind of, and that's the miracle, is consciousness. And, you know, I feel like we're squandering it. And the admin of our days want us to be, because it keeps us on this habit trail of consumption.
The end of that story is not an end that creates an ending to the plot of events. It's an end that has more to do with Billy's state of mind and what's happening internally for him. And it made me want to ask you about your idea of a satisfying ending to a short story.
Well, my friend Keith Morris, who's a great writer, you know, always says, you got to write a novel about Billy Clam. You know, you set him free in the world. You know, he rides off into the sunset with 7 pounds of cocaine. You got to let us see what happens next.
Right.
And, you know, I understand that. And I've certainly thought about that, you know, set Billy Clam, free in the world and let him traverse America, you know, like Don Quixote kind of tilting at his windmills. But, the problem I get into is that I really want my endings. I want to stick the landing. You know, I mean, I want my endings to, I'm trying to break people's hearts. I'm not trying to be like mean or sentimental, but I want to make an impact. And so, but there's a problem with that, which is sometimes, you can get polemical or sort of strong arm the reader. And, you know, so that impulse that I have is probably an overweening one, and I have to try to control it. But for me, I want the characters and the emotion that they are brought to at the end of the story to live on in the reader after the story's done. I'm totally uninterested in little burps of feeling. You know, I want people who are, you know, that story where it's sort of this polite accretion of detail and there's just this little burp of feeling at the end. Life's too short for that kind of sophisticated posing. And the species, you know, the state we're in, I think, is it's too short for safe little minimalist stories where you essentially say, this character's alienated. I will now show you for 15 pages how alienated they are. Or here's this little slice of life. You know, I'm interested in the single episode or era of somebody's life that is of the most psychological and emotional and moral consequence. That's all I'm trying to capture, is the most sort of radically meaningful moments of people's lives. And, you know, so that means that at the end, if I'm built a reliable ramp to that moment that really matters, I really want the reader to feel it, and I want them to come away from the story with the sort of elevated sense of feeling that I was getting to as the writer, and that I wanted my characters to be in the thick of. I don't know that I'm always successful with that, but that's what I'm going for. You know, I want people to be shaken up, not in a cruel way, but in a human way at the end, you know, at the end of the stories.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the story itself, do you look at it in terms of an arc, or do you look at it in terms of just sort of like a whole piece, is the only word I can think of?
Well, my notions of plot are very primitive. It's basically, you know, find character, push character into danger, you know, don't split when the character's in the middle of it. And so what I tend to think of my stories as doing, and I don't know if they do this successfully, but this is the theory, is you want to build a reliable ramp to the moments that really matter and then slow down as much as you can. So you're trying to build an emotional and psychological ramp. So in Tamil Pious, for instance, you know, this is all building to the moment where a couple of different moments, you know, the moment where he has to say goodnight to this woman and recognize how desperate and needy she is and how terrifying it is to live in that kind of need. And then, you know, the additional moment a few pages on where he recognizes how tenuous his own grasp on his sanity is. But the rest of the story for me is really about constructing a ramp that slowly but steadily brings the reader into that rising sense of kind of emotional danger. And, mm-hmm. and then when you reach the moments where it's really bearing down, to slow down and let the language, the sensual and psychological detail kind of compress in those, you know, to accommodate, to describe what somebody's feeling when they're really feeling lots of complicated things at once, it means that the language has to stretch and expand and become more beautiful and lyric in order to capture that, more poetic, I guess. And so that's, if you're doing it right, if you've engineered it right, that's not, you don't just throw a bunch of beautiful words at the page and think that it's going to equal truth. You come to a very painful, true moment, and the language naturally has to rise into beauty to capture it.
Yeah.
So that's sort of what I think of. That's a theory, is that I'm building these ramps to these very painful, true moments, and then I'm just trying to slow down as my characters are in them.
Parts of that story are very funny. We were talking about writing humor before, and so I want to ask you something that I noticed in your work, and I don't know if it's something that you do on purpose or if it's just something that works and so it happens, but you have this sort of 1-2 punch that creates a funny outcome. You will write a sentence that's factual or supposedly factual in this fictional world, and then you will write sort of a comment on that fact. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but so here's an example, and this is from an essay you wrote, but on the way down to Hartford, I was pulled over by a cop for eating a ham sandwich. It is illegal to eat pork on Connecticut byways. So right, and then there's one, this is one from the Jew Berserk on Christmas Eve, and I don't know how to, is it blasé? Is that how?
Yeah, blasé, right, exactly.
Blasé, okay. The blasés ate with grace and precision. I could never quite catch them chewing. So, and then this third one is from a story, What the Bird Said, and this is just a description of this man who's very frail and he's dying. He's still dressed like a man of wealth, but the elegant cuffs and tabbed collars merely emphasized his frailty. His clothing had begun to mock him. And that last one's sort of sad humor, and it's actually three sentences. But still, you know, I found this pattern interesting, that there's like this factual statement and then this comment that kind of makes us smile in some way. So I wonder if you can talk about that.
Well, it's sort of a form of slowing down. So the first thing is you sort of state the fact, and then you either kind of riff on it unexpectedly, or in the last example, I'm trying to get to the real emotional and psychological experience that his son has seeing this dad. In other words, mm-hmm. you know, there's the physical description of him shrinking and his clothing becoming, you know, the elegance of his clothing being that much more striking because his body is shriveling up and becoming mm-hmm. undistinguished and, you know, drained of life. But the second sentence, or the last sentence there, his clothing had begun to mock him, is really all about this complicated feeling that this kid has seeing his father, who is, you know, used to being the powerful one who mocks everyone around him, really reduced to this pathetic state. So it's much more about staying in that painful moment where our hero, you know, the son, is having to see his dad in this pathetic state, and not just settling for a physical description of the dad, but for the emotional and psychological impact it has on the kid. And that, I think, is, you know, writing is just an act of attention. Like, that's the whole thing. Love is basically an act of attention. It's the first and final act of love is paying attention. And mm-hmm. those second two that you stated, the first one I'm just sort of horsing around and mocking, you know, kind of mocking
right.
the police procedural. But in the stories, most often, I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to pay attention, and when there's a detail that's really evocative, not just settle for the description, but what the impact emotionally and psychologically is.
I'm sure at this point in your career, it's a little different than when you were starting out, but just sort of advice about how you figure out where to submit your work.
Well, I think there's certainly magazines that have a certain kind of sensibility. You know, well, Georgia Review tends to like more traditional stuff, and, you know, Tin House is more open to offbeat stuff, whatever. But basically, a good piece of writing in whatever register is going to get taken by a good magazine. So the main thing that I suggest to people, and I didn't follow this in my career very well early on, is just wait till you have a really good piece. And when you do, send to the big places first. Mm-hmm. And when they say no, then send to, you know, don't send pieces out to a small magazine and a big magazine if it's a piece you really believe in, because if the small magazine takes it, you're going to kick yourself in the tush. I also am a fan of saying, look, you know, wait as long as you can bear before you send stuff out and, you know, get other people's eyes on it, because there's no point in publishing, you know, and I did this early in my career, there's no point in publishing 36 mediocre stories, which mm-hmm. I did, competently written stories that aren't really going to make a difference in anybody's life. You know, they just, you execute it well enough. You have to, as much as you can, wait until you have work that you really feel is ready for the, you know, for the big time. And then aim high, and when they say no, you know, lower your sights a little bit. But I submit, you know, when I was submitting widely, I tended to multiply submit because it just takes so long.
Right.
And you only got one life, and you can be polite about it. You know, you shouldn't deceive people, but you know, it's kind of a buyer's market. And so as a seller of short fiction or essays, I feel like, you know, you should definitely make sure that you have an iron in the fire. The simple reason being that for me anyway, you know, that's what kept me going and to some extent still keeps me going, is the sense of, well, I've got a story out there. I could get that yes in the mail. And if I get a no, okay, I'll just take it. That's mostly what you get in this business. But at least there's a sense of possibility. And it's hard to write. You know, you have to keep your confidence up, and you have to keep that sense of, like, there's a point to it. Somebody's going to hear it eventually. You have to believe that.
Yeah.
Kind of do the Billy Clam of writing and stay at it.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, so one of the things that I really enjoyed reading was your essay on Vonnegut. It's a whole big piece about lots of aspects of your own relationship with his work and having met him. And you were very worried about making a good impression on him when you did meet him, because he was your hero, and he had been at a certain point in your life. You felt that he was the greatest writer of all time. Well, and so now at this point in your career, you have a following, and I'm sure you're a hero to many of your readers. You mentioned, you know, having done that reading the other night and hoping that some of those students will look at your work and other works, you know. So you're probably famous in a more limited way than Kurt Vonnegut was, but you have a following, right? So I wonder, first of all, if you can talk about how people act around you, but also how you act around them. Does that memory of meeting Vonnegut change the way you speak to people who are maybe nervous to talk to you or want to ask you about your writing, but maybe it's not a good time for you, or, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a big deal. I was just telling my wife when I was, you know, because I've been doing all these readings around North Carolina, and the bottom line is that it's a big deal to people. You know, I'm not a big deal in many circles, but you know, in life, you either can affect lots of people in a slightly more superficial way, or you can affect fewer people in a deeper way. And the great artists, Picasso and Dostoevsky, you know, they affect lots of people in a really deep way, which mm-hmm. is, they're great. But for me, I'm the kind of artist who's affecting a pretty small number of people, but in, you know, if they're really a reader of mine, you know, in a pretty deep way. So when they've got their own desires, most of them are writers of, you know, at the beginning of their careers. So it's a big deal when I'm talking with them, and they know it's a big deal, and they're nervous, and I know it's a big deal to them. And the last thing I want to do is kind of betray them, you know, or just be dismissive. So I try to really listen to what they're saying and give them what help I can, recognizing that, you know, I can't sit there at the keyboard for them. I don't have the magic fairy dust that I can throw on them and make them, you know, it's like there's no shortcuts in any creative process. You just have to sit and do the work, and mm-hmm. it's really hard to do. The most I can do is tell them, hey, I know how hard it is. I know how hard you're working, and, you know, that's beautiful. I can't write this piece for you. I can't even tell you you're going to be successful at this, but the endeavor itself is a blessed endeavor, and I have to believe that. And So I'm very sensitive to that. And it's a tiring way to move through the world because that's a lot of emotional output, you know.
Right.
It's really, really going to be present for people. But, you know, it's also, I'm awfully lucky to be in that situation. There's a ton of people who have gone off in search of themselves, whether it's creative writing or visual arts or, you know, filmmaking, whatever it is, and a very few of them who ever get to the point where they're able to put their work into the world and have other people dream their dreams, you know, invest their time and energy. So I get it. I'm really lucky, and I'm not about to be a jerk.
Yeah. Well, so I have one more question that's sort of related to this, maybe a little bit, but I'm wondering if you have any advice for writers as far as turning insecurity or self-doubt into something useful.
Well, I do think it is. I mean, for one thing, doubt is the sort of basic engine that drives most creative endeavor.
Yeah.
You know? Once you become really self-satisfied, you don't have that same hunger. It's the reason there's so many lousy second albums out there, you know, because the passion and the sort of desire to be known and understood and felt, you know, is so passionately there, and all that energy, that unrequited desire for people's regard and acclaim and attention, and suddenly it's met, and there's this big deflation. Like, oh, okay, well, now I'm just got to write about how lousy room service is, you know. So I do feel like that's a basic thing. When I think about my kind of why I became a writer or why I do this sort of work, it's like, well, I was in a family where I didn't get a lot of regard, and it made me desperate for it and very doubtful about my own worth. And those things still drive me on. You know, I can't get rid of them. You never get rid of them. You learn to manage them, you know, et cetera, but you don't ever get rid of that stuff. So that's the first thing, is to recognize that doubt and insecurity is part of what keeps you going. The other thing is that when I think about one of the things I'll give to students, you'd asked about a prompt.
Yes, right.
I'll say, you know, write, think of the most shameful moment that you can bear to think of, and just take and set it up clearly so we know where we are, you know, orient the reader, and then take us through those 5 or 10 seconds, or take us through that minute where your dad caught you shoplifting or masturbating, or you did something that still marks you, you still feel that twinge of real shame and humiliation about it. Chances are that's going to be a great piece of writing, and that people are not going to look at you and say, oh my God, you know, what a jerk or what a loser, because everybody has those. And you know, I really feel like the path to the truth runs through shame. That's just always how it works, at least for me. Mm-hmm. And it runs through other things, too. But centrally, especially with nonfiction, but even with fiction, it really, you have to disclose your own stuff. You have to be willing to put it on the line. And that, you know, for me, when I have an embarrassing, awful episode, I know that it's, to put it, you know, in sort of coarse terms, like I know that that's something that I'll eventually be writing about. I just know it, you know, like I did a talk at a conference about a week ago, and I'd had this horrible day where I'd screwed everything up. My daughter had, you know, thrown up, you know, in the middle of the night, and I'd had to deal with that, and everything had gone wrong. And I just immediately took all that. It wasn't funny at the time. It was frustrating and frightening and unpleasant, but I sort of knew what I was going to write about in this talk I had to give, which is those kind of days and how they make you sort of question, how they make me question, well, how did I get into this line of work? I immediately convert the humiliating, awful stuff, or if not immediately, I inevitably convert that stuff into, you know, little bursts of forgiveness, because everybody has that kind of experience inside them. And the people who are writers are oftentimes the people who are just more honest about that.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been just a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Steve Almond. You can learn more about his work at his website, stevealmond.com, and that's almond like the nut. Today's Write the Book prompt, you've already sort of heard it. It was suggested by my guest, Steve Almond, who said in our interview that he feels the path to the truth runs through shame. Think of the most shameful moment you can recall and then write about it. Set up the piece so that readers are oriented, and then write about those 5 or 10 seconds or that minute or two of shame. He says, chances are it will be a great piece of writing. And as he put it, you have to be willing to disclose your own stuff. You have to be willing to put it on the line. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. And they can listen to archived episodes at the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, or also on iTunes. And as a reminder, if you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or if you want to offer a writing prompt for a future show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I choose to use your prompt, I will absolutely credit you for it. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. It's an all-volunteer station. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.